like most of these people who were from the 60s and who lived in Stony Brook in a different world. Some of them are now retiring.
Yes.
Okay, but those are every one of those people, the Irving Cross, the Norm Goodmans, until recently Max Dresden, that I could name off who have always had their name around, were all from the 60s. And it was just a different world. So that was my first perception. And what the experiences stand out in my mind, I guess for me, because that was a great change for my involvement in it, was first when Jack came in, and then when Homer came in. Because to me, working for Homer was a wonderful experience, and he was a wonderful person, I thought. And
why do you suppose he left? Do you have any idea?
Yes. I mean, not that he sat down with me and told me in so many words, because Homer wasn't that kind of person. He was a very private person. We could be together like this at 7:30 in the evening, alone in the office, you know, after a full day, and we'd have to be there because there was some emergency, and he'd sigh or something like that, and sort of relax his body a little bit and slouch, and maybe say one or two things, but he would never say really what he felt in that sense. But working with him every day and seeing his rhythm and his concern, it was that I think he was wanted to be a totally honest person. And he just could not take the pressures of that, of what one has to do in a job like that, of doing things that one didn't think was the best way to do it. And many times I think that was one of the things that he simply could not do things the way that he always felt would have been the best way to do it. The other that I think antedates that reason, disillusionment of a sort.
Was the question money or the interests of people?
Okay, well, I should have said this first. The first was money, but that was not the ultimate. The money was in the sense that when he came here, I always had the feeling that he had been misled or allowed himself to perceive it as something else, that because he was coming to be provost, that if he was getting a promotion in a sense from his previous job. And yet, he used to repeat all the time how in that previous job he had control of larger amounts of money and all sorts of other things. And I remember the magazine that he started, it was because, this is just one symbol of it, but I think it's important, he used to show us he had the whole run of that in his previous institution, this glossy thing that he had been able to publish as being, what was his job there, something, research, a dean of research or something like that. I mean, so it was...
This Indiana?
Indiana, yeah. Yes. And yet he was able to do these things, and he wanted to say, well, at least I want to publish something like that here because I did that there. And so I think the first thing, I think there was an initial disappointment and a cumulative disillusion, is the way I would put it. The initial disappointment was that soon after arriving, he realized that Stony Brook had very special problems in the state system. And Stony Brook, in particular, and the whole budgeting of the state's New York state system, had special problems that he hadn't realized fully, and that he had more independence and more money and all sorts of things where he came from. And Stony Brook was a different kind of university. And so I think that was a big shock as soon as he got that message. And I'm telling, this is my impression. He never told me this in so many words, because as I repeat, he's not the kind of person who would do that. And then I think there was a cumulative disillusionment that was made worse because it was in Stony Brook and how some things function in Stony Brook, but part of it was within himself and his personality, which is that as good an administrator as he was and as honest as he was, or precisely because he was so honest, I think ultimately he didn't like that what one has to do, and one has to do doubly perhaps in Stony Brook, in such a job of doing what is not going to cause him problems, but leave him in a better life. He really wanted to do the right thing and felt himself blocked, one, because by financial and other reasons it was impossible, but also because it was not possible by the way things were being run and the deals that you had to make and all of that. And although he never said a single word to me about it, my perception was that he had difficulties with Jack also. He never articulated a single word to that to his senior staff. But I think he felt a sense of frustration there, and I think they have very different personalities and very different administrative styles. And ultimately, you could see the job he chose I think, answers that question too, because he went back to an administrative job, but in his field, where he felt, I think, that he could do a purer kind of administration.
Where is he now?
He is the chairman of physics, but with they gave him a lot of lines and so forth to build in Ann Arbor, is it? I think it's Michigan. So I think he sees his role as continuing in administrating, but in the role of a physicist who is an administrator and perhaps eventually going to Washington or something, but using his administrative skills tied in to the world of physics or the world of science. Because I remember one of the things that he seemed to be happiest about when he would be traveling, one of the things he was on is the National Science Board, I believe it was. And he would always come back from that very happy. And that was doing bureaucratic type things, but it was within the narrow confines of science. And I think that's what he found out. You know, he was a very young man when he came here. He was 40 years old when he came to this job. And I thought he had seen himself as being on a certain track. And when he got here, he realized things about himself, about Stony Brook. It's a combination of those things. And he wanted to go on a different track. But he's probably happier. I haven't seen him since.
Okay.
What was my understanding of my own place in the future of Stony Brook? Why do you think you were appointed? That's been very positive. I think that's one of the very good things about Stony Brook, that I never had any question about that. I never felt, I'm an assistant professor. Obviously, I worried about getting tenure, and there were all sorts of political problems. I don't mean to say that. But I never felt that I'm an assistant professor, therefore I can't teach this course, I can't do this, I can't have graduate students, I have to have a kind of pecking order. Maybe that was the way the department was, as I mentioned before, because my specialty was very unique, and so I obtained senior status in that way. And that's why was I appointed, was precisely because my field, plus the fact that they wanted someone to supervise the teaching assistants, and I had a lot of teaching experience. I went to a teacher training college as an undergraduate. I had been briefly a high school teacher. I had had a lot of experience in graduate school as a sort of super TA and various other things. And the language department was expanding and had a lot of language courses, and they needed someone to be able to train and supervise the TA. And the native speakers of Spanish were not going to be able to do this because they were not trained or interested in doing that. Rather like the problem in English of who's going to run the writing program, and the people who teach literature say, I don't know anything about that. So I was hired in part for my intellectual pursuits in medieval literature and in part for my practical skills in doing that. And I understood that, and whereas I worried that I was being made to work too hard, because at that time the senior professors were teaching sort of about half the load that I was teaching, and I was worried about getting tenure, but I never had a sense that I didn't know my place or why I was here or what I could contribute or that people could understand what I could contribute or anything like that. So I think Stony Brook has been a very good place in that sense. For example, this new assistant professor we just hired, she had been at Maryland and then somewhere in Washington briefly, and she would ask me all these questions like, I said to her, well, gee, I have a student who's doing a dissertation and I think you should come on her committee because your field overlaps with hers. And she says, oh, can I do that? Where I was, an assistant professor wasn't allowed to serve, you know. Yeah. So that thing, that I have never felt anywhere in Stony Brook, that kind of...
We're not yet bureaucratically organized to the rigid point.
Now, of course, that has its advantages and disadvantages. Basically, it means we don't have a separate graduate faculty, as you know. We don't have a list of that. And overall, I think that's been positive because very often, you know how the profession has changed, not just mine, but PhDs and so forth, in the last two decades. Some of the people who are young are much more well-published and much more knowledgeable than some of the older people. So to deny them the opportunity very often would be a very negative thing. So overall, I think that's been positive. It has the negative side that certainly departments have people who are not active in research in any way and end up teaching and directing graduate students that shouldn't be doing that. But for me, that has been a very positive thing in Stony Brook, that from the beginning, I never had a sense, academically speaking, as opposed to what we discussed before of the campus community, academically speaking, I never had any doubt about my own place or future or whatever.
Good.
What expectations did I have when I came? that really ties into the previous one, that I would be able to do the work that I wanted, and that has worked out. Have they worked out personally and for the institution? I think yes, very well. Academically, very well. What, where my activities confined to the campus, outside, central office in Albany, what capacity? Yes. I also served several years in a number of, at the time, that was eliminated sometime later, but there was the statewide Senate and there were statewide committees, and I served there on the curriculum committee at one time, and I served on the personnel policy at one time. So I did for a number of years commute a couple times a semester to Albany or to various things.
There have been two points of view within the system, particularly Sam Gould, I think, wanted to have it consist of a single university, and he wanted a centralized organization, a central faculty, and central planning for all of them. The other side is that the people who are on the campuses, if they have any intelligence and initiative, will develop a group sense and an institutional sense that is particularized and will think they can go ahead, and at least in our case, that the institution can go ahead faster than the people in Albany plan for them. There's a relativism in Albany that that tends to hold back the institutions that can go ahead faster. Mm-hmm. And that's always been the case. There's an egalitarian feeling. And in the case of many of the people in the central office, an inability to understand how the units differ mm-hmm. in function and level of ability. You see that in many, many instances. It's a system that is different from California's.
Very, yeah. But also, the whole system, not just the limits on it, is much more badly funded.
Yes.
I was a visiting professor. Not only was I a graduate student in Berkeley all those years, where, of course, I didn't know the inside details, but I was later in 1980, I think, a visiting professor at UC Davis. And it was quite a shock to me what kind of money was floating in just an average Spanish department, where they were funding graduate students to go to conferences who weren't even giving talks at the conferences. I mean, just all sorts of things and services that a campus like Davis had, which was the same age as Stony Brook, but less prestige within the California system than Stony Brook is within the New York system. It was quite a shock for me to have a day-to-day comparison of how things function in those places. By the way, Ivan Shulman was the name of the chair of Spanish.
Who?
Okay. Ivan Shulman was his name.
Ivan Shulman.
Yes, he was only here for about 3 years, but he was a very, very powerful figure who was a very conflictive figure. Okay, shall I continue?
Sure.
Where are my activities? Oh, that was the Albany, yes. It was a very useful activity in Albany. I met a few interesting people, but didn't really do anything. What do you feel you have accomplished? I had accomplished Stony Brook by 1971. Well, I wasn't here in 1971, so I hadn't accomplished anything. Can you name individuals who do things who are important for the future as a whole or some part of it?
You've mentioned Goodwin and Max Dresden.
You've probably interviewed them already, haven't
O'Neill.
You?
O'Neill.
Oh, it's not, yes, your question is not that to get more names, just who I saw as being important.
That's
right. I think Max Dresden was very active. I don't think he did anything major productive, but he was this Emmy Nosgavis. I think Norm Goodman was very active. He was one of the most helpful people at that time, I think. Jim McKenna was very helpful to me at many times. I felt he was, I know he got a lot of bad flack from a lot of faculty, but I thought he was also very knowledgeable and has a sense of the university.
What kind of flack and why?
Oh, he was in that unfortunate position that one is that I was in later, that if you are a very senior but a staff member, as opposed to a line, you end up being seen as the henchman for your boss. And I certainly was aware of that when I worked for Homer. A number of people chose to perceive me as his henchman. Sally Springer was the other associate provost at that time, and I don't think they ever had that perception about her. But when McKenna was working for Gelber earlier, in a slightly different structure, for a while he was the only person there, and for a while Lewis Miller had ostensibly the same title, but he was always the person in the scene as the one who carried out the bad news, or perhaps was seen as advising his boss to do that. So I think that's where that perception came from, because Gelber had a certain manner that he always said yes to everybody, and if the final answer ended up being no, Jim was seen as the, at the very least, the one doing it, but very often as somehow he was behind that. What other individuals were important? Well, obviously, Toll put his mark on Stony Brook in many ways that were still there. And I know there are people in the university today, I don't share that view, but who say, in spite of all of his shortcomings, he had a strength and did certain things that the present president does not do. I don't share that image. But for people in humanities, since the perception of Toll was one, literally, I think 100% of people in humanities felt that he had no interest in them, even though I would have to say, obviously, he had a tremendous impact on the future development, for all of us, that had to be seen in a negative way. Because we did see, and probably we still see, that a lot of why we got so little of anything, why we're in the library still in temporary quarters, why humanities is the only one that never got a building, why I have a room like I have, which is always airless, or in winter it rains in and it's 50 degrees, you know, why I have colleagues who are full professors and have rooms with no windows and that kind of heat, and that people don't have in other places, that ultimately goes back to John Toll's leadership, and I'm sure he did many things that strengthened Stony Brook. But from our little enclave over here, since we got none of that, I don't think there's anybody in humanities that you could talk to. I'd be very surprised if there's anybody in humanities you could talk to, and we sure disagree among ourselves about lots of things, who there's no one who feels, I think, that our current lack of status and poverty and physical, disgusting physical plant does not go back ultimately to the time that he could do and he could spend that he gave nothing to us. So my answer number 15 in many senses is a negative leadership from our point of view, looking at it as humanities.
One of the things that I feel is unfinished business is a building, a sizable building for the humanities.
As you know, it was planned, supposedly.
Located as close to the library as possible. One of the original mistakes, I think, was to put chemistry so close to the library, biology so close to the library, which they don't use. But that's simply illustrative of the kind of thinking that we had in the beginning. Rockefeller, fortunately, was a Phi Beta Kappa from Dartmouth, and you didn't have to talk in terms of one syllable about State University, but the planning of this campus was done before he came.
You're going back to what I mentioned before, just the actual physical planning of it has so many problems, from the commuting to the wrong buildings being in the wrong place, but that, unfortunately, how can that ever be improved?
Well, that is a $64 question, and I think it's going to be addressed. I really think it will be.
Well, there's another issue that I'd want to mention that ties in.
All right, let's hold it for just a second. All right. Go ahead. Another issue.
It's tied to the same issue, because you interestingly came back to that same issue I started saying about how the campus was built with the administration in the middle, and what you're saying correctly about chemistry and these buildings being in the wrong place is so important for everyday movement in life, there was no town planning. But exactly in relation to that, I think if I were now empowered to say, it's so difficult, but what could you do? Where I put a tremendous amount of emphasis, and something I know about because when I worked for Homer, part of my job description, the two main things that I spent a tremendous amount of time on one hand was personnel policy matters and so forth. So I know the faculty very well, as it was a few years ago. And the other was the physical plant, that I was the liaison with Bob Francis. And that whole space assignment, change of space assignment, rehab of space, and all of those things, then of course the bus system and all of these things are tied into that. And how incredibly terribly that worked. And if you could improve that, not the holdings in the library, not the intellectual atmosphere. We have a pretty good library, as a matter of fact, as far as holdings. It's one of the things I think, in my estimation, works quite well. Some of the services in the library work quite well, and I've used a lot of libraries, and I have some knowledge about that. Yes, we're not computerized enough in the right way and whatever, but there's a human element there. But the whole physical plant, every aspect of it, from the dirt on our floors and the garbage not being picked up, to somebody drawing graffiti or pulling a hole in our classrooms and you go there. I mean, I used to teach in a classroom that somebody had punched a hole in the wall, one of these paper walls. Some other student had come in and drawn female genitals around the hole. And that was there for 6 months or a year, okay? That kind of thing. That I sat at a desk and opened the drawer and there were all the empty pizza wrappers. That students break into our offices at night. It's not their fault. They do it to study because there's no place, there's not enough study places in the library. All of these interrelated things. The bus comes in, you can't get here because the bus system doesn't see fit that it has any relationship to anything else, classroom hours or where the train comes in. And talking about space, the rehab of space is a very interesting, important concept, because in any university, even if it had been well-planned, which it wasn't, as we're saying, but even if it had been well-planned, things change. And as things change, as for example, I was involved in applied math, and another department next to it having problems about one having too much space and the other having not enough space and one wanting to take over and rehab this border space. It was never resolved. Partly because everybody feels the space they have is like their property rather than it's university property. And partly because nothing gets rehabbed. Religious studies, which moved into what we called old physics, moved into there, 6 years ago. And they still have in all the offices, because it used to be a lab, all the water running and all of these kind of things, no rehabbing. Now, rehabbing, relatively speaking, compared to making buildings, doesn't cost that much. And if you had a decent system of doing that so you could respond to needs, departments shrinking, enlarging in size. For example, Complit and Religious Studies combined into Comparative Studies a year and a half ago. Half of us are here, half of us are in the other place. One secretary there, one secretary here. We can't function as a department. There were very good reasons, bureaucratic, intellectual. We have a very large graduate program that involves both of those faculties, that we should be together. Nobody opposed it, bureaucratically, intellectually. But we can't function fully because we can't be in one place. Okay? Before that, and I'll finish on that note because I said my shades is a story in that. Complit was born out of classics, just on courses in Greek and Latin, and then when Complit was started, it was put on top of that, and they became one department for bureaucratic reasons. It was an undergraduate program. Then it started becoming a graduate program, and I became its chairman second year into that. It was about 9 to 10 years ago. And we had tiny, tiny little quarters on the third floor. And we started growing, getting graduate students. Jan Koch, one of our world-famous senior faculty, had a little closet, inside the hallway. On one side we had Spanish, and on the other side we had German and French in those departments.
Which building was this?
Right here, on the third floor. Okay. And we were growing and growing. Spanish was also growing, so that was a problem. French and German and Russian were not. But they had much more space. So the first thing, we could get, years and years went by, we couldn't get allocation of space, even though we had all the justification. Because we had the graduate students and all of those things. There could be no adjustment made because the system wouldn't function that way. Then, when I went to work for Homer, We had a 5-year review and of our graduate program, and because I was chairman and I was working for Homer, I was able to politic on this a little bit, and the reviewers liked our program very much, but I told them, well, be sure you put in the report how disgusting our quarters are and that this was your problem, which they did. And only because I was working in Homer's office and I was in charge of that, I was able to take a legitimate need. I mean, I wasn't using my influence, let's say, for something that wasn't deserved, to take some space where we now are, which was an empty Carrolls and people slept there overnight, whatever, and to have that space rehabbed to be our quarters. And then our space downstairs could be taken over. Now, this eventually got built in a year and a half, but would never have gotten built, I'm convinced, if I hadn't been there at that time. Then it got built, but certain things that were not allocated at the time, such as the shades, even though they have all glass thing, there has been no way to obtain shades. That was 8 years ago. Goodness. This is why when I go in there at 8 o'clock in the morning, and it's 100 degrees in there because the air doesn't work, and the sun comes in, I can't work in my office. Okay, I'm not trying to tell you a personal anecdote. That's not the point of it. If I were a normal faculty member, what I would do, as they do, is they just bitch. And they say, complain to the chairman, or it's the chairman's fault, or it's dean's fault, or whatever. I happen to know the precise history of how the place was built, why it was built, why the shades aren't there, and why, indeed, we are never going to get a shades, because there's no budget for that sort of thing. If for some reason it didn't get into the original budget of the rehab, plus some furniture, the prison furniture, by the way, which fell apart within a year, so a year after we had these new quarters, we became a slum, because when people made holes in the paper walls, they were not replaced because the prison furniture fell apart. It wasn't, so you have a different quality. As administrators can get this kind of quality, but the kind we had there, but the chairs fell apart, plus students came in and stole them or whatever because there's no policing at night and so forth. So within a year after we moved in there, the place looked like a slum, and the things we hadn't gotten in the first place, like it wasn't quite finished, like the shades, we're never going to get because that should have been in that original allocation and it wasn't. There is no avenue, no dean gets budgeted for that, and whatever, so it's just never going to happen. So all of those little things that make the quality of life so abysmal, just coming into my office and seeing a pizza wrapper thrown there, you know, from students, or walking into my office and seeing that students had broken into my office and studied there and dirtied it up and that sort of thing. So I think the physical plant, really having someone with real vision, and some power and some authority and an interaction with the provost's office so that they simply say at some point, okay, applied math, if you have too much room, we're just going to take it away and that's it. It's not your property. All that kind of thing, not having departments think it's their property and having the rehabs really work. We could respond to changing needs.
How did Bob Francis do? What kind of, was he a good problem solver or problem identifier, or wasn't he backed by Toll? Or
no, it wasn't Toll. He was here when I was in administration and stayed longer. It was under Jack.
I see.
Well, I never understood. I don't know how he was hired and all that. He was already there when I got into administration. He had a degree in English or something like that, so I never quite understood, first of all, how he got into that thing. He was a nice guy, certainly. He didn't seem to me to have any kind of vision. He didn't seem to have any knowledge. He didn't have enough technical knowledge of the field. On the other hand, he wasn't an academic either to understand what academic needs are and what is the what kind of offices you need in one classroom space. I remember one anecdote about that, of being in a meeting with him when we were planning what size the offices should be. And he says, but we could get more offices in there. If you make the office this small, and he gave the figures, you know, they're Albany figures, and if you don't clutter it up with bookshelves and things like that, you could get this many offices in there. On the other hand, neither he nor I, working with him, was ever given the authority to say that after I went, and I remember how many visits I made to applied math, and all the space that they had there was totally unused. And I think it was a chemistry, or who was it next door, or a regular math that needed the space. And I could go there and consult and write reports and whatever, but no administrator ever wanted to be the bearer of bad news and say, okay, it's not justified, you don't have enough graduate students, you have this many square feet, somebody else has this many square feet, they need the space, we're going to reallocate it. And then say to Bob Francis, okay, now it's a priority. You go in there and fix those four rooms so that Matt's graduate students have a place to see their students or whatever the particular need was at that time. And nobody ever took those hard decisions. And in our part of the world, nobody does anything at all. You know, they break in, they destroy things in our offices. Nobody ever comes to fix it up. And years go by that there's no repair done.
Okay.
And this just makes for a daily, very squalid, that's the word I'd have to use, a squalid physical environment, which really changes your view about how you feel doing things every day. I mean, last Monday, I was here about 12 hours. I was seeing all the graduate students, graduate director now. I come in at 7:30 in the morning. I was in a total sweat in this office with no air, with no shades, and whatever else. I mean, how do you do... I'm not an assembly line somewhere doing physical labor.
You know where the... have you talked to Ron Lohman?
I have never gotten anything out of Ron Lohman.
Okay. All right. Well,
maybe you've had better experience, but...
I'm not sure that...
Besides, I don't know what funding he gets or whatever. You know, I don't know how much of it is his doing. Some of those things certainly could be fixed up very locally in the building, but...
Okay. All right. That way at the end?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.